Welcome to Hacking Your Leadership. I'm Chris, and welcome to today's guest interview. Our guest interviews are long-form interviews with leaders from around the world. They've each been selected because of their valuable perspective on leadership and work they've accomplished in this space. Today, we're joined by Jim Harter, Chief Scientist of Workplace Management and Well-Being at Gallup, and co-author of the new book, Well-Being at Work, How to Build Resilient and Thriving Teams. Welcome, Jim. Say hi to our audience.
Hi, everybody. Great to be with you today.
I want to start with the fact that you've been at Gallup for basically your entire career. How did that journey start? And more importantly, how did you turn it into something you could be passionate about for three or more decades?
I didn't really know that I'd land in this particular field. I knew just from feedback I'd gotten, even in high school, that I could write pretty well. And I knew I loved numbers. And I also knew I was very interested in people, but I didn't really put it all together. I kind of got lucky, actually. I went my senior year in my undergraduate work. I went down to the internship office at the University of Nebraska and filled out a couple of applications. I got both of them as internships. One of them was with a travel agency. Another one was with a company called Selection Research. Selection Research ended up purchasing Gallup, and the two organizations basically merged together. Don Clifton, who's the father of strengths-based psychology, I got to know him really well. And he asked me after I graduated if I wanted to work with him in research. And so I figured I better give that a shot. So I did all my graduate work while I was working with him. I just became more and more interesting, the study of people, putting science and measurement around people and how they think and feel. Just became very interesting to me. Over time, it's been great working with our team and evolving our team so that you can kind of continually do what you do best and keep refining your job so you can continually, you know, there's things in any job that we don't want to do. But over time, if you do it right, I found you can just keep getting better and better at doing what you do best.
Yeah, this is, the world is pretty big, but it's also very small. I'm geeking out a little bit on this interview because I'll tell you, you know, my background is in psychology. And one of the first kind of experiences I had when it came to how people work was related to Gallup. I was a newly promoted store manager for Best Buy when we went into strengths-based leadership and strengths-based work. And you know, my top five are woo, communicator, strategic, command, and relator. And I remember having my phone call with a person from Gallup who kind of taught me how those five things relate to each other. And, you know, I remember, you know, going through the years when I got my results, number 34 out of 34 strengths was empathy for me. And I was like, oh my gosh. Oh, is it you too? You too? Yeah. And, you know, if in hindsight, I look back on it and I think, yeah, that makes sense. In the years after that, I had people who were familiar with strengths-based organizations ask me if empathy was in my top five. And it was because I was so worried about how that being last would impact me that I made like conscious efforts to do things that would be in the spirit of showing empathy for others, and almost like a fake it till you make it. And over time, it's what helped me become an empathetic person. And I feel like I am today. I feel like if I took those same tests today, it would be much higher than 34 because I actually, you know, believe the things I'm saying now. I love this work in general, and especially how they interact with each other. You know, being told that it's not just what each of these things mean, but in how they relate to each other, and having specific things next to each other in your top five, that makes a difference in terms of, like, you know, how you relate to other people. I love stuff like this.
Well, I think the strengths piece you're talking about is one of the most important foundational components of just becoming more efficient as a leader, working with other people more effectively, because it just changes your starting point. It allows leaders to build trust with the people that they're working with, because it changes the conversation. You've got a language around yourself and them that is positive and is a common language, and that you can just kind of keep exploring together.
Yeah, I think it has profound implications when it comes to just people being happier at work, because it's the knee-jerk kind of human reaction is to look at the things you're not good at and try to get better at those things. And if you just put that same effort into making sure that you're just doing the things that you are naturally good at, or that at least, that speak to you, you're expending much less, emotional capital trying to work on things that are just, trying to fit a round peg into a square hole. And you're less likely to end up in a job where you spend 30 years doing something you didn't like because you were just trying to make it work.
That's a great point. And if you take it to the next level, even working on one of the things we really explored for this particular book that we worked on during the pandemic, was that strengths, if you're going to get well-being right, you need to aim strengths at that too. And so a bunch of us put together an appendix that goes through each of the 34 strengths and maps them to each of the five well-being elements that we talk about. So it makes it more, I guess, actionable from a well-being perspective to think about how we shouldn't expect every person to be an athlete to have high physical well-being. We shouldn't expect everybody to have to be a multimillionaire to have high financial well-being. We each need to do it our own way. And if we know ourselves well, we can do it our own way, and we can do it much more efficiently. It's not such a big mountain to climb. Well-being is that's something that nobody really has perfected. It's an area that we always have to work on because it's kind of the ultimate. Thriving is you feel really, really good about your life right now, and you think it's going to be even better in the future.
Yeah, I agree. I'm excited about this interview because it fits into a lot of stuff that Lorenzo and I are talking about on the show right now. A few weeks ago, we posted an episode. We do every Thursday, we do what's called Thoughtful Thursday, which is a shorter episode around something small that we don't think needs a full episode, but we kind of touch on it a little bit. And there was an article I read in Entrepreneur Magazine about the importance of being okay with being a messy leader. And I've always believed people are messy in general. And so I gravitated towards the article. The article itself actually cites a Gallup poll around how daily worry has risen from 37 to 60% among people in the full-time workforce from just 2019 to 2020. And just the idea that three out of five of my coworkers are worrying about work on a daily basis is a staggering number. But if you look at like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, on-the-job suicides have risen every year for the last, several years, and they haven't even reported 2020 numbers yet. And so I think it might be short-sighted to say that this is pandemic-related. This seems to be the pandemic is just another thing on top of a growing problem of mental health, issues in the workplace or work-related mental health. First of all, why do you think this is happening?
Well, just to kind of comment on the statistics you mentioned, we did see a big spike during COVID, but you'll see in a report that we'll have out in June called the State of the Global Workplace, which we're now updating every year, the long-term trends on negative emotions, like you mentioned, worry, stress, anger, sadness, have all been steadily rising in another kind of bump up during COVID. So the question, yeah, a really good one is why? And I'm only referring to workers. It's the trend is very similar for the general population, but if you just think about workers and that trend going up, it creates quite a challenge. But I think one of the reasons is that even for employees that are engaged, they may not have the rest of their life that supports what they're trying to get done at work. So people who are engaged and not thriving in other aspects of their life report much higher rates of burnout, or 60% higher burnout than others. So it's really the whole picture that organizations, I think, now need to be thinking a lot more about. And this didn't just start because of COVID, as you mentioned, Chris. If you look at the trends pre-COVID, the newer workforce was asking organizations to think about their whole life, not just the workplace. The work-life separation is kind of a thing of the past. And it definitely was during COVID, but it was trending that way even before COVID, where the expectation is my organization should help me with my overall life. It doesn't mean that an organization should pry into areas that people don't want them to, but they should open the door because it is the whole person. And in many jobs now, we're working all over the place. You know, we're not just going to the office and working every day. We carry around these handheld devices that remind us of things all the time. And the blending is just so much greater now. And so the organizations of the future, for many reasons, including the big emphasis on ESG that we see all around us now, environmental, social, and governance, the organizations of the future will be thinking about the whole person and how they can impact the whole person, not just the worker. And it's because if your workforce is coming to work and they've got other parts of their life that are dragging them down, they're just not going to be as effective. You see higher rates of absenteeism, you see higher burnout rates. Bureau of Labor Statistics also is actually the CDC, I guess, reported this year in 2020 that last year in 2020 that symptoms of depression and anxiety were up significantly. If you trace they looked all the way back to 2014, compared some of their statistics, and so that's up also. It's a problem, but I think organizations are in the best position to contribute to solving it. A big part of our lives is work. And, you know, there's so many tentacles from work to all the other elements of well-being that I think organizations are in a great position to be thinking about how they can affect some of these trends we're seeing.
Sure. There are definitely things that organizations can do as a whole. You know, when you're talking about in aggregate programs they can have, whether it be, you know, including, you know, stronger mental health, health benefits in the healthcare plans, or, more time off. We've seen things where, you know, the organizations who say, oh, you get unlimited time off, that in a lot of organizations, that really just means you get no time off, because even though it's unlimited paid time off, if the culture isn't such that says, hey, you know what, we value you more when you are rested and when you can take time away, so we're going to force this kind of on you to happen, you know, so unlimited, but you have to actually do it. Very few organizations are doing that, and more could. But there's also something around what the leadership does on an individual basis. And so in most organizations, you know, you don't have people listening to this show right now who are the policy makers of the organization, the ones who can say, oh, I run the total rewards program for my organization, I can include this, or I'm in the C-suite, I can affect change here. Most of these people are saying, I have to work within the constraints of what my organization currently is. And so if I'm trying to be a better leader and I'm trying to help my people have well-being, but I can't necessarily increase the number of, you know, health-related benefits, you know, what do I do as a leader? If I feel like I want to do the right thing by my people, but I'm seeing this increase that you're talking about.
I think leaders can do a lot. Of course, organizations can set up all the policies, programs, and perks. Doesn't guarantee a culture is going to change, though, necessarily. But those are all, you know, the policies, programs, and perks are all good. Ideally, an organization will align them with the five elements we found organizations and individuals can impact. Your career, we've been talking a lot about your social well-being, your financial well-being, your physical well-being, and your community well-being. There are things organizations can do around every one of those. But if you're talking about an individual leader or manager, I think the best thing that you can work on is the transition over time. And some people be further along on this than others, but a transition from building a culture of boss to one of coaching, and to move from that kind of boss, traditional manager mentality of delegation, which is still important, but to one of coaching. And what does that mean? Well, it means that you got to pay close attention to the nuts and bolts of managing people, which includes helping people set goals and expectations, in involving them in that, not just delegating, but involving them in setting their own goals, having ongoing conversations that are appropriate for each individual. And you've got to know the individual to know what works right. We found there are five different conversations that matter a lot, and that needs to be adjusted to the individual. But at minimum, we found that every manager or leader should have at least one meaningful conversation with each person at least once a week, at minimum. For some people, it'll be more than that. So that's a good goal to be thinking about, one meaningful conversation per week. What does meaningful mean? That's that you got to get underneath that a little bit. We talked a little bit about it with strengths, right? You got to know their strengths to make it meaningful. You got to know who they are. You got to know what their work is. And you got to keep up to speed on what their work is because things change a lot. And to coach them effectively, you've got to know those things. But what's going on in their life too, as much as they want to share. But you can open the door for the kind of conversation around how work and life interact, and that's been incredibly important this last, I guess, over a year now. And then the third thing about coaching is accountability, and that's really important too, is to help people know how they're doing and to give them feedback and to have some accountability so there's so that so people get rewarded equitably for what they're doing. If I'm producing more than someone else, I should be rewarded for that, both in terms of recognition and other ways. So those three components I think are really important. And if you keep it strengths based inside of all that and engagement focused, so you're focusing on the elements that really engage people in their work, then setting expectations, ongoing conversations, and accountability are three areas that everybody can get better at. And when you get those right, you open the door for the bigger well-being type conversations because you've built some trust. If people don't have high trust, they're gonna hold back, and you're not going to be able to impact their well-being.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think those three things though are chronological in and of themselves. I think that the accountability piece by definition has to come third. We talk about them as a group of those three things, but they can't all happen at the same time. The accountability has to come third because a person I've always believed that people want to be held accountable. People are desperate for accountability, but they only want to be held accountable by someone who they believe has their best interests at heart, not the interests of themselves. And so it's like if I'm giving you feedback on something you've done wrong, Jim, and it's in the context of how you can make my life easier, that lands very differently than I'm giving you feedback on how you can open doors for yourself and your career. And you can't fake that. Like you have to believe that in your heart as a leader, or what you're saying to your people will come off the wrong way, and you will hurt trust. It's almost better to not have the conversation at all if you can't do it right.
Agreed. You've got to approach it the right way. And this is we've been talking underlying all this is strengths, but strengths helps you build trust and change the conversation in a way that is positive. It leads to less awkward conversations. If you think about like a manager or leader who traditionally hasn't had those kind of ongoing conversations with people and has been maybe more hands off, maybe even somewhat ignored people or maybe just delegated it, and now it suddenly is trying to change how they do things. That can seem really awkward to on both sides, but to change to start with strengths changes the conversation a little bit because you've just acknowledging their strengths. You've acknowledged a new language around them and some things that you didn't really know about them before, at least didn't have kind of summarized that way, and that can lead to high levels of trust.
There's also some value in a little bit of a mea culpa moment too. Like if you're a leader who's done this a different way, when you've really tried to compartmentalize work away from the personal and to kind of keep it professional over the compassion, I think just kind of laying it on the table and saying to your people, hey, just so you know, I know this is gonna come off like I'm a different person when we have these conversations, but know that it's because I want to do this and I see the value in it and I've not been good at it in the past and I'm trying to get better at it. But when you see it from me, I mean it. This is what I want to happen and I mean it. And if you feel like my actions outside of these conversations don't align with what I'm saying to you right now, I want you to call me out on it because if you're seeing that's not who I want to be. I want to be what you're seeing right now. And then you have to mean it. You have to actually follow through with it. But I think employees will give their leaders a lot of grace if there is that transparency around the things that they struggle with as a leader. Also, if this doesn't come naturally to them.
Yeah, that kind of openness and humility, I think, goes a long ways. Something in our human nature gives people the benefit of the doubt when they have those kind of moments and awakening, so to speak.
Yeah. So in the book, you mention what you call the best possible life. What's the nutshell description of what you consider to be the best possible life?
Well, we had a chance before we published this work in 2010, but we had a chance because we have this resource called the Gallup World Poll, where we can study people all over the world. We do it every year. And we had a question. The question was, are there some generalizable characteristics in people that lead to great lives, life evaluations, and also good days, really good days with lower stress and worry, like we're talking about earlier, and high levels of interest and enjoyment? And we didn't know the answer. We studied it all over the world, and we found there were five areas that they don't explain everything, but most things that we think about our lives will fit into these five categories. And they're those five: career well-being, social well-being, financial well-being, physical well-being, and community well-being are five areas all of us can do something about, and they contribute to the best possible life. I think that getting there is a journey, and there's always challenges along the way. So it's there's always things to work on, but it gives some structure and some measurement and some categorization to some areas that we can fit things into and make sense of our life that way. So it's really thriving in those five. The foundational ones are career and social. Career is the most foundational because it touches so many different areas of our lives. And in fact, if you look at people who are dropping out of the workforce and get depressed, and there's some common, we've looked at a lot of variables that lead to that. And the two big ones are having a job that's a miserable job for you, where you're disengaged. And if it's your length of service in that job. So really having a bad job for a long time is a big factor in that. And there's a lot of studies around the connection between workplace and health. We've done some of them ourselves. The White Health studies are a really good reference also, looking at workplace environments and health outcomes like mortality rates and coronary heart disease. So getting the workplace right is really important and foundational. And when you get the workplace right, you're by default working on those two foundational elements of well-being. So I'm talking about getting the employee engagement part right, where people know what's expected of them. They have people in the work environment that care about them. They when they do good work, they get recognized for it. They have coworkers that they feel very strongly about, positively, and they respect, and that are even some of them are some of their best friends. And so by default, when we're working on these engagement elements directly related to work, we're working on career and social well-being. And that's an important, really important starting point for being opening the door for other elements of well-being, like financial and physical and community. The community well-being component was, we found a differentiator between a really good life and a great life. And if you dig deep into that, the reason is that at the highest level of community well-being is giving, is contributing back in a way that's unique for you individually. And that differentiates when people are giving in a way that really makes sense for them individually, in whatever, you know, whatever time of life it is for them. They would say things like, my life has exceeded my wildest expectations. So there's that component. At a foundational level in community well-being, it's about living in a safe place, you know, and having the kind of housing that you and your family need. But at the highest level, it is about that altruistic piece. And organizations can play a huge role there, not only in what they do for communities, but what they, how they get their employees involved in giving back and making the community better.
I think it's so important. Having close interpersonal relationships, whether you're talking about inside of work or outside of work, is just, it might be the most important thing, because we are social creatures. And if we're in a situation where we don't have that, I think we naturally want to compartmentalize that to as small a part of our life as possible. Like there are things that we have to do that we don't necessarily get to interact with the people we love the most. You know, that's just part of life. But maximizing the amount of, you know, awake time that we have with the people that we enjoy being around, you know, I mean, it's the difference between a person who goes to work and they view work as their happy place, a place where they can help remove their mind from the stuff that might be the stressors at home, you know, or the stressors outside of work, you know, being energized at work because the people they work alongside are committed to doing the high quality work they are. And you know, these are people who, if you were offered a different job and you left tomorrow, or if they left tomorrow, that you would still keep in contact with them, because the relationship is based on more than just that you happen to be on the same team. You know, those are all just so important to engaging fully in your job. You know, I don't think we have the ability to do our best work unless those kind of boxes are checked.
I really like your point. I was just, the social piece is who we are. You can't take the social part out of a person when they come to work. It just doesn't work that way. You could even, I've actually heard people over my long tenure that say we frown on social relationships at work. And in most cases, they actually score higher on a question we ask called, I have a best friend at work. You can't legislate that. You know, how do you legislate whether people socialize or not? In fact, it's probably people who also on the other end of it say, isn't it really difficult to act on the social component? How do you make people get along and be friends? Well, it's probably the easiest element of the 12 that we ask on our engagement measurement, because it's really about creating situations where people have a chance to get to know each other. In many cases, it's just through normal work. But making sure people have a chance to learn things about each other and getting out of the way and letting human nature take over.
Yeah. We need those jumping off points. We need those, those pieces of commonality that we can see as a jumping off point, because I think people are tribal in nature. You know, we look for strength and security among people who we look at and think, that person, I can relate to them in some way. And I think when you talk about organizations who do a great job in the diversity, inclusion, and equity spaces, those are the organizations who do exactly what you're talking about best too, because what they're doing is they're creating environments and they're creating situations where people can find those jumping off points that are rooted in more than just what's on the surface. They're rooted in what your goals are, what your interests are outside of work. And if you can find those commonalities with your coworkers, then the things on the surface, they don't matter at all anymore, because we all have them. We just don't necessarily naturally tend to look for them. And so I think if organizations who kind of, they don't, you know, not force it to happen, but allow it to happen, I think it will happen naturally.
Yeah, there's a concept in academic research called interpersonal congruence. And it's really what you're talking about. And the studies that I've looked at on that, and we've done some of them ourselves, show that diversity itself doesn't necessarily lead to better outcomes. Diversity in combination with interpersonal congruence. And what they do to build interpersonal congruence is just what you're saying. You create situations where people have a chance to get to know one another as people and learn something about each other. And you can do it really quickly. But if you have that in combination with the diversity, it's better than not having the diversity. I think we're just built as human beings to work in diverse environments. I guess you could say the more diversity you have, the better a chance you have at meeting customer needs even.
Oh, for sure. There's also this element of, you know, if you do that second piece, if you talk about, you know, if you take steps to make sure you have a diverse workforce, but you don't take that next step, then the efforts you put into having a diverse workforce will have to be matched year over year to continue to make it happen because of the attrition that will occur because of the lack of those social interactions that occur. But if you can take that second step, it becomes something that feeds itself, and you have to do kind of less intentional work in that space over time to eventually, I think, you get to a place where the cycle just kind of feeds itself, and you kind of have to keep tabs on it, kind of look at it. But this kind of really intentional, you know, thousands of hours a year that organizations put into making sure they have a diverse workforce, you know, there are steps that those organizations could take to lessen that amount of effort they have to put into it if they are, you know, taking full advantage of what people will want to do naturally if they let them do it.
Well said.
So I want to tease a question really quickly here. And this is on the subtitle of the book. It says, How to Build Resilient and Thriving Teams. And, you know, I've heard for a long time that resiliency is one of the strongest indicators of a person's success, not just at work, but at life. And to me, you know, if I'm looking at it as a leader or as just a person in general, resiliency, if I'm a leader and I'm trying to build resilient teams, what that says to me is, it's not my job to stop problems from happening. It's my job to make sure that my team can react appropriately and move through the problems when they occur, because they'll be stronger coming out the other side. So I want to talk about that. But first, if you don't mind, we're going to hear from a word from a sponsor. All right, we're here with Jim Harder from Gallup. And right before that little ad, I kind of teased the question about how to build resilient and thriving teams in the context of resiliency. You know, what if I'm a leader, how do I build resiliency in my team as opposed to the knee-jerk of I'm going to solve the problems for my team?
You want people who are going to take ownership during tough times. We can't avoid tough times. You know, we've been studying employee engagement, for example, dating back to the late 90s. We've actually been measuring aspects of it way before then, but we've had a chance to track employee engagement during two previous recessions and then again this past year or so. And what we found is that there are certain elements of engagement that predict performance even stronger during tough times than normal times. Elements like, do I know what is expected of me? Do I have an opportunity to do what I do best every day? Do I have the materials and equipment I need to do my work right? Can I see the connection between my work and the mission or purpose of the organization? So to have that kind of, like you're talking about, Chris, that level of involvement where when you have the choice during tough times to either go in fight or flight mode and look out for yourself and hunker down and protect yourself, or to try to help the organization persevere during those tough times and changing direction and everything you've got to do to help the organization and to put in that discretionary effort that that whenever somebody's hired, that's what leaders want. You've got to have some of those foundational things in place. And the organizations that had already been working on engaging their workforce pre-COVID got through it pretty well. I mean, as well as you could. It was a tough year for everybody, still is. But they were set up with the kind of culture where people are more, have higher autonomy. They have high, could just call it psychological ownership for the organization, and put in the extra effort that was needed. In some cases with furloughs and in some cases with layoffs that had to happen, you've got people doing, you know, a lot of work, a lot more work than they would have done before. But that level of ownership is really important for a resilient culture. But it starts with those basic elements of engagement, making sure people know what their role is, helping them see how their work is connected to something bigger. There's something about seeing how your work connects to something bigger in a crisis that keeps you pushing. Instead of just thinking, well, this is just my job, I've got to do it, and in a kind of a siloed way. So that part's important. The other element we saw during past recessions was they have these resilient individuals have tremendous respect for their coworkers. So they're not just doing the work on their team. They're thinking about how their work relates to other people's work, and the handoffs are so much better across individuals and across teams. So they're more likely to say their coworkers are committed to doing quality work. And part of that comes back to something we talked about earlier, Chris, with accountability. If you've got managers and leaders who are creating high levels of equity and fairness through accountability, then it's clear to people how their coworkers are performing, and the right people are getting rewarded for the work that they're doing. So that's important. Just one other thing I'd say that we wrote quite a bit about in this area of resilience recently, and we did as a pandemic came on, and we started tracking some of these perceptions of what leaders can do to affect followers in the areas of hope. Are they creating a clear plan so people know what's going on? And think about how much was shaken up when everything just changed. We call it the great shift, where we went from 4% of people working 100% from home pre-pandemic to 48% full-time and 70% at least some of the time. And so that's quite a shakeup in how we work. People need to know what the plan is, and they need to know if the leader doesn't know. You know, that piece about honesty, and I don't know everything, but here's what we do know, and here's what we're going to do, and we're going to adjust. There's a stability component about, do I feel prepared to do my work? Do I have the resources I need to do my work? There's a trust component, and that's really about, is my manager keeping me informed? It's that simple. That's those ongoing conversations, meaningful conversations we talked about earlier. Are they happening at enough frequency and with the right kind of content so I know what's going on? And is there compassion? That's a big one. Do people feel their organization cares about their overall well-being? So in a crisis, in this particular crisis, people were affected by compounding factors, not just one. People are very resilient to one thing going wrong. But when you have 2, 3, 4, 5 things that are changing in your life suddenly, you've got to have a manager or leader who helps you adjust to that and considers your situation. So that compassion component is big. You know, in organizations, we ask that question, does your organization care about your overall well-being? The variance across organizations is from 30% strongly agreeing to 90%.
That's a big gap there.
Yeah. So a lot of variance. So organizations are doing very different things in that area. And so it's to think about how it's possible to get to 90% of people strongly agreeing that the organization cares about their well-being. That's a hell of a culture.
It's interesting what you say about, you know, the different questions you ask that kind of determine, you know, what you say is psychological ownership. You know, I have an engagement survey that I administer to some companies in my consulting practice. And this question of the, you know, the I have the tools and equipment I need to do my work right, that kind of Gallup really created, you know, a long time ago. It's interesting to see people on the exact same team report vastly different answers to that question. And those people have access to the same things. And so if one person is saying that, yes, they have the tools they need, another person saying, no, they don't, you know, what's the difference? And it's this, you know, it's this kind of this psychological mindset when you go into work of, if there's a problem, is it my problem to fix, or is it someone else's problem to fix? And if you believe it's someone else's problem to fix, I think that in the moment that can feel freeing, like it's not my job to fix it. In the long term, that is devastating psychologically to an employee who wants to feel engaged in their work. Because if a problem is not, even if it's not your responsibility to fix it, if you can't own it to fix it, I couldn't personally be in an environment where I felt like anything that went wrong, there was nothing I could do about it. And so it's not about blame or responsibility. It's not about, well, there's a problem, just because I can fix it doesn't mean I caused it, doesn't mean I'm the one to blame for it. It doesn't mean my leader's the one to blame for it. It's can I feel like this problem is something I can tackle, or do I have to sit on the sidelines and let someone else tackle it for me? And the having a workforce that is that feels that one way versus the other way, it's just it's incredible what you can accomplish if your people feel like they can just tackle it.
It shows you how much of it is listening to people and what they're and giving people the autonomy to change things. And the psychological part of it, because you probably saw back when you're in retail that you could have all these stores, same box, you know, everywhere with the same materials in it, but vastly different perceptions about what's available. And changing that isn't always real expensive. Sometimes you got to change a computer system or something, but, you know, in many cases, it's just about awareness and ownership.
In the book, you talk about four risks to a thriving culture, and I want to talk about this because of these four risks, there's one that kind of stuck out to me a little bit, and that's risk number four, which is poorly skilled managers. I've always believed that most poorly skilled managers are not poorly skilled by choice. They're not there's nothing nefarious or malevolent going on there. I think you have a lot of people who are kind of they're the result of thriving economies promoting people for the wrong reason. So your organization is successful, therefore it is assumed that you caused it, as opposed to that we would have succeeded anyway without you being the leader or without you being this employee. So you get promoted and then you end up leading a team of people, and you might have been the best person executing, but the skill of leading that team has nothing to do with the skill of executing. And so you have these people who are poorly skilled leaders. Without eliminating, millions of people in middle management across the workforce, how can organizations tackle this from a standpoint of inviting these middle management people along for this journey, but also making sure that they understand that this journey for them can't last 10 years because we have to get better at this? I think it's something that a lot of organizations really struggle with.
Yeah, it doesn't need to last 10 years. I mean, you can make significant change in how people are capable of managing other people in a short period of time if you have the right tools. And I kind of refer to them as shortcuts. But what I'm optimistic about is that even though, organizations on average have promoted people into managerial positions because they're good individual contributors, or this is what managers tell us, by the way, they're good individual contributors in the past. And it was kind of their rite to passage, or they've just been with the organization a long time. Not necessarily the best way to pick people into managerial positions, but that said, there's a lot of room for growth if we just upskill people and give them some of the right tools. We've seen significant improvements in the engagement of teams through some of this upskilling. So I'm optimistic about that. I think that there are other in terms of the problem that exists now and how to fix how people get into managerial positions, that's a different kind of an answer. But you can, of course, pick people with the natural traits that fit into. We've done a lot of work in that area as well. But I think organizations could also do more kind of, I call it game film, where they actually give people a chance to do kind of a tryout, to try managing other people. And many of them will realize how difficult it is and will opt out of it because of that. And as you said earlier, Chris, people are messy. And that doesn't hit home any stronger than when you're trying to manage them in all the complexity that each person has. And so managing people is a real gift. And our goal with that kind of boss to coach journey approach is to shorten the distance for the people that are already in managerial positions and give them some tools to get better and better. And that's very possible. But I think effective organizations kind of look at it from both of those angles at the same time, though. Can you develop people into good managers, or are they born that way? Well, the answer is yes.
I like that comment, 'cause it brings me to the last question I have for you, and it's more of a personal question. You know, at the beginning of this interview, you said that you like data and you like people. You know, at some point in your career with Gallup, you went from an individual contributor to someone who had a team reporting to him. And, you know, at the beginning, I don't know if you ever said to yourself, I want to be a leader in this organization, meaning I want to be responsible for the growth and development for others, or if you said, I really like this work, I really like this data, I really like what the organization stands for, and then at some point in time you found yourself kind of naturally moving up and having a team reporting to you. What's kind of like a struggle that you have had in transitioning from one to the other? Because I think a lot of people who really gravitate towards the things that you're passionate about, they don't necessarily naturally gravitate towards the leadership roles, but they're needed in all elements, right?
That's a really, really good question. You know, one of my strengths is focus. And sometimes it can get in the way of managing other people because I like to not only get other people on the team to do research, I like to do a lot of it myself too. I like to write. I like to, I get a lot of fulfillment out of getting absorbed in our work. And so that's always been a struggle for me is knowing when I need to shut that off and I need to spend time with other people. One of the things that I found in terms of my role with our team is I found I can be a decent mentor, but I've got to use the right strengths to do that. So when I'm a mentor, I'm going to be thinking more about using my learner strength. I'm going to be using individualization. So I know each person on the team is different and they learn things differently. And so I focus more on mentoring and recognizing and just doing work together with our team. So it's not as much like a delegation sort of thing. I've never really worked that way. It's more and to be quite candid, we've got our team has really our research team has three leaders. We've got Ed O'Boyle I work with. He's a global practice leader, and he works on the consulting side in terms of thinking about how all this translates into organizations we work with, and is it translating in the right way? Can they use it to create change? And then Emily Meyer, she handles all the administration and has meetings with people on a regular basis. So I found it works best if it's in a kind of a team context, and I don't have to try to do everything. I think sometimes when people are in managerial leadership roles, they think they have to do everything. And finding those right kind of partnerships, I found has been really, really beneficial. Emily will just do all kinds of things. She brings energy and organization. I bring more mentoring and partnering with the researchers, and Ed brings more kind of the component of connecting it to how we create change in organizations. So if I'm, you know, really candid, that's I don't expect myself to be to cover all the bases when it comes to leadership.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, you work for the organization who kind of invented StrengthsBase, so it wouldn't really be great if you were, you know, kind of forcing yourself to do things that you weren't great at, and instead of relying on that wouldn't look very good. So that's good. I like that you're kind of you know, leading with you know, where your strengths are, right?
There are other people who are much better at some things than I am, for sure. If you can admit that to yourself, then you're one step closer.
I love it. All right, Jim, the book came out yesterday. I'm seeing some good praise about it on Amazon and the places where I'm, you know, seeing reviews on it. You know, ask something of our audience. Where should they go? What should they do? Is there a website they should visit? Does it matter if they want to pick up this book and you know, talk about well-being at work and talking about building resilient and thriving teams in their organizations? You know, what would you suggest of them next?
So yeah, you can go to Amazon.com and you know, that's a great place to pick it up. You can also go to our website, gallup.com, and we've got, in addition to the book, we've got all kinds of other resources available, our ongoing reports that we produce. We have a State of the Global Workplace report coming soon that'll update all the trends across the world on workplaces. And I'm on LinkedIn too. So if anybody wants to connect on there, I'd love that.
That's fantastic. Jim, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. I'm sure our audience is going to get a lot out of this. I'm really enjoying the book, and it's making me think about some things that I can do with the people that I lead. And I hope our listeners get the same thing out of it.